Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Checking in with Sergeant Robert Derry with Troop G in Bridgeport, the State Police. Sergeant, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm doing great, Melissa. I hope all's going well with you over there at the station.
Thank you. I always appreciate hearing from you. So first of all, Sergeant, it's been a few days since this happened, but what was your initial reaction to the governor's executive order on Monday having to do with police restraints, military weapons, training, all of that?
Well, I can tell you, Melissa, the Connecticut State Police, just about everything that was in that executive order, the Connecticut State Police are pretty much already doing. In my 26 years on this job, all the training we receive has been extensive. And, you know, just for example, a lot of the equipment they give us, we've had cameras in our state trooper cars for, coming up on 20 years, I bet now. And then over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been rolling out body cameras. So I think we're ahead of, probably ahead of the curve when it comes to law enforcement training and equipment. So and I think we always are kind of look visionary, looking forward as to what can be done to make our jobs safer for us, safer for the public.
So it sounds like Troop G has already been following these protocols, if not recently, for years it sounds like you have been. Now, I would love to get your, actually just a straight answer on police training, because I know that continues to come up, not just with state police in general, but I think policing across the entire globe. There have been a lot of studies coming out recently showing that in other countries, police will go into training for 2 to 3 years. Now, what is the typical training? What does that look like here in Connecticut? You know, to become a state trooper, what do you have to do and what do you go through?
Well, it's kind of a very long and involved process. I was on staff at the State Police Training Academy a few years ago, so as well as going through it 26 years ago. So I have a pretty good understanding of it. And just to even be selected to be considered what's called a trooper trainee, which is when you're in the academy, you go through a very, very extensive selection process. So and that's true of all law enforcement. You know, in Connecticut, they require a polygraph examination, a very extensive background, which, you know, and that's they're going to go visit your past employers, your family, your friends, your education institution. So they by the time that package is done and provided you pass all the different areas of the selection process, you know, the departments and the state police, we have a pretty good understanding as to who you are based on all that information. So there's a lot of authority and responsibility, obviously, that police officers have upon successfully completing their training and getting out on the street. So law enforcement organizations have to make sure that they have the proper people in those roles. So that's just one step. Now, should you get selected and pass all that, the State Police Training Academy is over 6 months long, and it's residential, which means you live there. And I can tell you from firsthand experience going through it and as an instructor, It's not easy by any stretch. It's very disciplined for a reason, because as state troopers, when you're out there on your own patrolling, after all your training is done, all your field training is done, you passed everything, you have to be able to make quick decisions by yourself, because although the state of Connecticut is a small area, we still, troopers, and especially in rural areas, are out there by themselves covering a wide range of area. So you're not going to have somebody like me, a sergeant, to be there to tell a trooper how to do their job all the time. So it's very extensive, and I think we do the best we can, and I think we put out a very, very good product in our state troopers.
But and I do know that Connecticut overall certainly hasn't seen what maybe some of our bigger cities across the country have seen. But when you hear about places, let me just think if I can come up with the names that I was reading. I believe it was Norway, Finland, Iceland, in some other countries. You know, when you hear that they are required to do 2 years of training, 3 years of training, and you hear that the United States, or at least here in Connecticut, it's 6 months of training, does that reflect that we are not doing enough training? Should our programs be much longer than that?
My personal opinion is it's not necessary, only because that we are constantly what's called in-service training, going back for in-service training. So you know, you have your initial what's called recruit training, which kind of gives you the basics. You have to pass a whole litany of topics and tests, and it's very, very extensive. Now, when you go back for in-service, that's giving you updated information and new training. So our training never really stops. It just continues throughout your career. So, I can't speak for what the other countries do because I'm not really all that familiar with what they do. But I can tell you, by the time for the state police training, at least, when the trooper comes out and graduates the academy and we do a 40-day working field training process where the recruiter, the new trooper, rides along with a senior trooper, and they get evaluated every single day. So the long answer to the short question is I think our training is pretty darn good.
Okay. Okay. And I know that we're running out of time, Sergeant, but I wanted to get to this other thing because I know we're going to have Lieutenant Jim Perez with the Fairfield Police Department come on in a little bit to talk about this. But the ban on chokeholds. Now, we've heard from police across the state saying that, getting rid of the chokehold actually leaves them vulnerable. And now you're relying on other ways to restrain, which actually could be more harmful to the person that you're trying to arrest. What is your response to chokeholds?
Well, I can tell you in the state police, we've never been trained to utilize chokeholds. That's not a normal course of.
So you have other alternatives you use. You guys use other stuff. You guys never do chokeholds.
Sure. No. The biggest thing, and even before all of this recent issues have come to light, it's all about de-escalation. And I go around and I talk to people and I say, I have all this equipment in my cruiser, on my belt. I said, I got to be honest with you. The most powerful tool that I have at my disposal is my mouth. It's the way you talk to people. It's your communication. And I've been involved in many situations over the years where that's what's kind of worked the best. And don't get me wrong. There are situations where some people just aren't going to listen. They don't want to even talk to you. And there's other reasons, there's other ways of dealing with that. But I can tell you the last thing that, in my experience, that a law enforcement officer wants to do is to utilize force on somebody unless they absolutely have to. We do the best we can. And, it's one thing about this job, I can tell you, is that every day, even throughout all the years I've been on, you're always learning something new and something different.
Absolutely. Well, Sergeant Derry, I appreciate you taking my questions this morning. I know not always the easiest subject, but certainly very much in the forefront right now. So I appreciate your insight. Thank you.
No, thanks for having me on, Melissa. Have a great day.
Absolutely. And I know we'll check in with you again soon. Thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I am well. Great to be with you as always. Hope you and your listeners are well, too.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Now, Governor Lamont signed an executive order earlier this week for state police, and it was banning chokeholds. But through research, hearing a little bit from police, first of all, it sounds like our state police don't even train to do that at all. But some police have said that, banning chokeholds and taking away certain restraints has actually made it now they're a little bit more vulnerable. And it's very different than somebody kneeling on someone's neck and cutting off circulation. What are your thoughts? Do you feel like the governor acted too quickly to put restraints? Should we have waited to discuss this and debate this, or was this the right call?
The law enforcement professionals I know, and I was the United States Attorney, the Chief Federal Prosecutor, as well as Attorney General for 20 years, say that chokeholds are really unnecessary and potentially extremely dangerous. So that kind of practice, I think, should be banned, as should be the no-knock warrants in drug cases and other kinds of practices that actually may be dangerous without being productive. And I think the governor did the right thing, and our proposal says that chokeholds should be banned in the United States Senate. So does the Republican proposal. So I think there's a lot of agreement on it.
And I was reading earlier yesterday about other countries and comparing them to the United States. Clearly, you could see in other countries, they'll do 2 to 3 years of training. And I'm sure that includes de-escalation training. And I'm mentioning places that I had read, like Iceland, Germany, Norway. They have officers, like I said, training up to 3 years before they even hit the streets. Whereas the U.S., we just heard from Sergeant Derry in Bridgeport that our state troopers will be in training for 6 months before they go on the streets. Why? Why is there such a difference? Because we're seeing in other countries that there are way less police officer-involved shootings than there are here.
That's a really good point, Melissa. One of the proposals in our legislation that is hopefully going to make it to the Senate floor and be passed by the Senate and the House as well would provide for more training, more funding for training. You know, these proposals to defund the police, I would oppose defunding, that is dismantling or reducing support and investment in measures like training for the police, because I think that's exactly the professionalism we need across the country. And Connecticut's training program is actually better than many state and local police programs elsewhere in the country. But even more important than training, or as important, is recruitment and screening.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stop people who should not be wearing the badge from becoming police officers before they are on the street, potentially killing people the way that happened in Minneapolis and in Atlanta most recently.
Well, when you talk about recruiting, it's interesting because I go back and forth on this a lot, wondering why is it that we don't recruit a more diverse class of people? When we look at it, you know, first of all, there is obviously a little bit, there's a division between police and the public in some ways, maybe not here in Connecticut as much, but certainly we've had our faults here. So I could see where people maybe of color don't want to become a police officer. But then on the other side of things, you know, are we even actually going out and finding people correctly? Are we actually marketing state police correctly? And what I mean by that, Senator, is, you know, from insight I got earlier this week during our special highlighting the African-American community, you know, when you're doing job interviews and things like that, are we reaching out to the proper places to find people of different diverse backgrounds? Are we doing the best we can to actually recruit? Because otherwise, it seems like you're right. We don't really have diverse departments.
Correct. And the answer to your question, I believe, is no, we are not doing enough to recruit people from the black and brown communities. In part, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, if a police department lacks diversity, it's all the harder to attract people who feel they mm-hmm. are going to be a very small minority in that police department and perhaps be discriminated against. So the point here is that it's a really complex and difficult task that requires comprehensive efforts to recruit and accountability to make sure that police who carry a gun are held responsible when they fail to fulfill certain standards. And the standards and training are very important. Recruitment is key, but also screening out the people who are potentially dangerous while they're carrying a gun and wearing a badge. But I think that we should also value the public service that police provide. And of course, I propose a hazardous pay bill, a heroes fund for firefighters, police, all the doctors and nurses who have served during this pandemic. So they do perform an enormous service to our community. And I think people who are in the black and brown community should be attracted to it in whatever way we can do it, because we need to make our police forces look more like the communities they serve.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, thank you so much for taking the time to weigh in on all of this. And I know I'll talk to you again next week.
Wonderful. Talk to you then. Thank you.
Thank you. Luke Fry with the Better Business Bureau is here now. Luke, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you? I have my coffee.
Good.
So I'm good.
Good. You're ready to go. And I know I have travel plans, and I'm so excited that you wanted to talk about this today, because we are headed to the Outer Banks in August. And
oh, fun.
Yeah, thank you. We're excited. We're a family of 10. So, you know, we got a pack.
House, Outer Banks. That's nice.
Yeah, right. It's only 10. Only 10 of us. And I think if you add the two grandkids, it's 12. So there's a lot of us. And, you know, three cars headed down that way, not getting on a plane. But you've got some great tips and things that we should be discussing, because I think a lot of people are itching to get out of here, wouldn't you say?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people are kind of on the fence of, should I travel? Should I hang here at home? However, we have been in quarantine, so I think a lot of people are trying to get out there. Mm-hmm. So we do kind of expect to see a decent amount of people either trying to travel. We also expect to see an increase in RV and camper rentals as well. So if you are going to rent an RV, rent a camper, that top tip is, whatever size RV you rent, make sure you are able to drive it. Since RVs over a certain length, you have to have some other type of driver's license, not only your normal driver's license. So a great tip there. As far as going out of Connecticut, going down to the Carolinas, even if you're planning on taking that short weekend trip, kind of, you really have to check what state regulations are in place where you're planning on going. I have parents back in PA, and even taking a short trip back there, things are totally different in Pennsylvania than here. Mm-hmm. And every place you go, it's kind of a weird time. I mean, our entire country is not on the same wavelength right now. Mm-hmm. So do you have to pack masks? Do you have to have them on there? You know, lots of questions to ask. So prior to going, I would say, is kind of see what you will have to do in order to make that vacation seem kind of normal. Are you able to go out to eat? Is it only outdoor seating where you're traveling? Again, lots of questions to ask prior to heading out the door.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because it's so true. My parents and my sisters went up to Vermont a couple of weekends ago just to get out, and they've had a longtime generational house up there. We have a condo up in Vermont. And when my parents got up there, you know, we have allowed for outdoor seating in Connecticut. They haven't even opened up restaurants in Vermont yet. Like, not even, they're not even really doing, like, curbside pickup, really. So when my parents got up there, they're, we have to go to the grocery store. We can't eat out. So, you know, it was something that they had to find out when they got up there, which is fine. But you're right. You know, you, especially when you're making these longer drives, 5, 6, 10 hours, you probably want to know ahead of time, should I be packing food or can I even eat out? So you're right. You got to check those things.
Exactly. And if you are traveling, are you getting a hotel? Are you going to have a condo and a house where you will actually be able to cook? A lot of people go to a beach and kind of just grab a hotel and say, hey, I'll go out to eat, or I'll grab pickup. And if you're traveling to a place where pickup isn't available, or even eating out isn't available yet, you could be in a little bit of trouble. I also had a lot of questions about travel insurance.
Yes.
So if you are planning on flying, if you, you know, if your parents are out west and you have to go see them or aunts, who knows, people are trying to travel. Travel insurance won't always cover a pandemic like this, even now. So even though there's increased policies where you can cancel, we are kind of on that brink of time, I would say, where I believe the airlines are probably going to start cracking back kind of on who they will allow to cancel flights for and who they won't. So keep that in mind. And if you are buying travel insurance, make sure it covers even if you are uncomfortable to travel. A lot of people have a travel insurance policy now and actually won't get refunded since the place they are traveling to is open. They just feel uncomfortable traveling.
So, that's true.
Really reading those fine lines of your insurance policy to make sure it covers, even if you change your mind about traveling.
And I've got to imagine, Luke, because whenever you come on, I always know there's a scam somewhere. And I don't mean from you. I'm saying out in the world that you bring my attention to. Are there online scams happening, especially if you are going to do like an Airbnb or even hotels? Are there online scams happening right now?
I don't know even if Airbnb is back up. I know a while back Airbnb kind of halted all rentals.
Mm-hmm.
However, that doesn't mean that there are scams out there. So again, any sort of rental scam, online scam, always doing research on a company or a site or even a person prior to handing over a couple $100 to go take a trip is always a smart idea. I don't have any scams top of mind right now as far as traveling goes. Again, just really researching any travel company, leasing company, rental property company prior to paying.
Okay. And can you give us your website so that people can go and either check, you know, the scam tracker or just be able to learn more about the coronavirus?
Sure. Yeah. To check our scam tracker, it's bbb.org/scam tracker. And then any other questions about any of the topics I talked about, you can always go to bbb.org/news.
All right. Simple enough. Luke Fry from the Better Business Bureau. I appreciate it. I feel a little bit better with the trip coming up in about 2 months. So I appreciate you for giving me peace of mind. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm always here for you.
I know. You really are. Poor Luke. He's not going to tell you on the air, but I will text him randomly, like on a Saturday, and say, Luke, so we had this company, and I'm pretty sure we're getting scammed. And he'll say, yeah, no, it's like, it's totally fine. Or, oh, yeah, no, just send me the... You're so good to me. I don't deserve
you. I don't mind it. That's why I'm here.
You're good. You're a good man, Luke Fry. You're a good man, Charlie Brown. I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right. Have a great rest of your day, Melissa.
Good morning, Greg. So glad you're here this morning. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Doing really well. Thank you.
Good.
And you?
Good. I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for asking. So there a term that came up yesterday while I was talking to your team. I had never heard of it before, and maybe our listeners haven't either. Enrichment for animals. What is that?
Well, that's something that is very important, vital for animals, our animal family here at the zoo. We have been doing this for many, many, many years, and it's an evolutionary process in how we work with animals in zoos over the years. Many, many years ago, we were looking at how we could take care of animals medically, because animal veterinary medicine was new. I mean, we're going back 50 years. And then we went to animal nutrition. What's the best thing we could feed animals? Not just, you know, prepared diets, but things that could be a little bit more nutritional for them, and how we could look at nutrition. And then as we move forward, we look at, okay, now we're looking at actually the medical and mental health of the animals here at the zoo. And this has been going for about 25 years. And a lot of people don't realize what enrichment is. Enrichment is, again, we have our animals here that do not have to go hunting. They do not have to protect their families. They don't have to worry about getting sick as much as they would in the wild. Don't really have to worry about finding shelter. So if you take away all those things, you can get bored. And so one of the things that we've been doing for years is enrichment. And enrichment takes the form of many different things. So let's just say even for our animals like our tortoises at the zoo, tortoises love to push things around, because they like to make sure they're protecting their territory.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is no other tortoises around, they're not really, worrying about territory too much, what can they do? Well, we found out we gave them wiffle balls. And wiffle balls were something that they thought was really interesting, and they pushed the wiffle balls around like they would push around competitors in their territory.
Oh,
and it was
funny.
Really interesting to watch them doing this. Enrichment can take the play. It can be in the form of scents. It could be visual. It could be playing. It could be toys. It could be just something new in their habitat. We found that's interesting in ocelots. One of the favorite things for ocelots was Chanel number 5.
Are you serious? they've got a lot of class over there. My goodness.
They're a little class over there. We found out Chanel number 5, we spray that around, little dabs of it around inside their habitat. They would immediately go to those areas and smell and really you could see they enjoyed it. So enrichment is for every animal here. It's not just for you know, some of the bigger animals like the tigers, which we give them big toys to play with so they can rip apart,
right.
Or treats they can we hide around in the yard. It goes all the way down to even our cockroaches that we have in our Hanson exploration station.
It's so funny. I mean, to me, so first of all, you're going to have people now showing up, you know, wearing Chanel No. 5 just so that they can get an ocelot to come into their laps. So that's going to happen. But it sounds like, Greg, that obviously there's a lot of trial and error with this and also knowing these animals very well. But it seems like you're also kind of giving them a sense like they're not so out of their normalcy, if you will. So wherever they came from or whatever habitat they were from, it doesn't feel like it's such an out-of-body experience. It seems like they're still getting a little sense of what they would have been experiencing if they had been, you know, I don't want to say left, because a lot of them are in recovery or you're trying to rebuild those numbers. Mm-hmm. But you have like this fine balance, it seems like.
What you're looking at is you're trying to have them simulate their natural behaviors,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they would. And what is their natural behaviors, whether it's foraging, whether it's digging up something, whether it's climbing. And what's interesting about enrichment is if you do it all the time and the same thing, it's not enrichment anymore because it's not new.
Right. Sure.
So our staff actually have a person on staff that's in charge of enrichment for the animals, and she does all of that work. I believe even today we're going to be talking about enrichment on our Facebook Live at 1 o'clock. If you tune in on our Facebook page, you'll be able to see that. But we also have a checklist. So again, we go down. What is the enrichment? What is the goal of the enrichment? These are all checklists that we have as an evaluation form. Does it work? Does it not work?
Mm-hmm.
Is there evidence of it actually being beneficial? Is it not being beneficial? So now we have an actual log of all the animals and what we've used and what they've liked and what they don't like. And that way we can modify as we go along down the line.
I love that.
I
was going to say, when you bring up benefits, are the animals happier when they have enrichment programs in place versus zoos that may not do that?
What you're trying to do here is, again, is eliminate boredom. It's give them something to think about. It's something for them to simulate their natural behavior.
Mm-hmm.
What you're looking for the benefit of that is, and again, at our zoo we see hardly any of this, if not none of this, is what we call stereotypic behavior. Stereotypic behavior is those ones we've seen in zoos where the animals pace back and forth and
mm-hmm.
back and forth and back.
Yeah,
and
that
forth.
Makes me so sad.
And and they just look like they're just mindlessly walking. That is something we do not want to see. And this is what enrichment helps us with. This is what enrichment does for all of these animals here. And enrichment also comes in the form of training. There is enrichment training is, again, behavioral training is also a form of enrichment here at the zoo. So if we're doing behavioral training to help us with medical procedures, that is also enrichment for these animals.
That is so cool. Now, of course, Greg Dancho, who's the executive director of Beardsley Zoo, you said you're going to talk about this more on your Facebook later today. Can you give us your website and also Facebook where people can find you?
Yeah, it's beardsleyzoo.org is our website. And it's Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on our Facebook page. Again, please look at that if we're coming to visit. Again, for your listeners, we are open. We have limited capacity. And you really have to get on our website and get a reservation before you come on and visit us and see what's going on here at the zoo.
I did mean to ask you, Greg, before I let you go, as far as phase two is concerned, I know that meant that also expands to indoor for zoos. Have you guys decided to start looking at indoor opening sooner? You're sticking with what we're doing. It's working.
We're working with what we have right now. We mm-hmm. are evaluating indoor facilities. The indoor facilities lead us into a little more challenge in that we have to have enough staffing to make sure that we get people through the building so that the rainforest and some of the other indoor facilities. We are working on that right now. Again, it's a day-to-day process, and we hope within the next week or so the rainforest building will be open and we'll have volunteers stationed at the doors to ensure safety. We've talked about this before, that we really look just to ensure safety for our guests, our staff, and our animals.
All right. Well, Greg Dancho, thank you so much for always taking the time for Zoo Minute. Learned a lot today, and we can learn more on your Facebook page later on this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
Absolutely.